It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The latest Marquette University Law School poll has Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers tied in the race for governor. We get the latest on this race, plus a look at the U.S. Senate and Attorney General campaigns, and a peek at how we feel on some of the major issues in our state. What do you make of the state of the governor's race? What questions do you have about polling in the race for governor, and what about for U.S. Senate and for Attorney General? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or WPR Mornings, the Twitter handle. Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
The latest poll that you've done shows that Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers are in a tie. What's your take on this race based on the latest data?
We have the race at 47% for both candidates, and in a bit of a fluke, it turned out to be exactly the same number of respondents for both of them. So it isn't even a rounding error that they're equal. They're exactly equal. This is in line with what we've seen all year with the governor's race. In June, with likely voters, we had Walker ahead by 2. Then in August, we had a tie. In September, we had Evers up by 5, but then in early October, Walker by 1, and today or yesterday, this exact tie. I think that is consistent with our polling that shows this is a very tight toss-up race. It's fair to say that other pollsters from other organizations have typically shown Evers ahead by anywhere from 2 to 8 points.
Well, let's briefly get into the makeup of those polled. What does the sample look like and how many were involved?
Sure. We interviewed 1,400 registered voters statewide, and of that, 1,154 are likely to vote. Those likely voters have a margin of error of 3.2 percentage points. And our sample is with likely voters 1 point more Democratic than Republican if you include people who lean towards a party, and it's 1 point more Republican than Democratic among those who don't lean to a party. So I think the partisanship is an even split either way, as is the governor's race.
We have an email from Matt who writes, if Walker is favored by 96% of Republicans and Evers by 93% of Democrats, how can they be tied considering Evers has a 7% lead among independents?
Sure. Well, because there's also a few people who don't identify with the party. There's also a third-party candidate in the race, Libertarian Phil Anderson, who's getting 3% of the Democratic vote, but 0% of the Republican vote. So that's holding down the Democrat just a little bit because Democratic identifiers are nevertheless supporting the Libertarian. And then the Libertarian also gets a fair chunk of the independent vote. I believe it's about 7%.
Yeah, that seems really counterintuitive to me, that the Libertarians would be eating into the Democratic vote. Wouldn't Libertarians normally be more sympathetic to Republicans?
Libertarians go both ways. There are some elements in which they are pro-social issues, like marijuana legalization, for example. Other ways in which their free market approach at least used to be pro-Republican, though, as the Republican Party has shifted on issues like free trade and tariffs and much more protectionism and nationalism, you're seeing, I think, less of a free market orientation within the GOP now.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. You can join us to talk about the latest results at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What do you make of the state of the governor's race? What issue is the most important one to you this election season? Which of the gubernatorial candidates has your vote when it comes to that issue? And what questions do you have about polling in the race for governor? Governor, again, that number, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas at WPR.org or mention WPR Mornings on Twitter. Charles Franklin, as part of the Marquette poll, you're also asking people about the most important issue to them this election season. Walk us through those.
Yeah, we asked this in August as well. Things haven't changed very much. Health coverage is the number one issue for 25% of the voters. K-12 education for 20%. Jobs in the economy for another 20%. Those two are tied. And then a somewhat distant fourth is roads and highways at 12%. And then there are a variety of other things that are down in single digits, including taxes, prisons, the UW, and aid to local governments. What we see, though, is that it's probably not a surprise. The issues you see the candidates emphasizing tend to favor them. So health coverage, if that's number one, 65% of those voters are going for Evers, 32 for Walker. On K-12 education, 70% for Evers, 21 for Walker. But on jobs in the economy, that goes the other way, 20% for Evers, 74 for Walker. And on roads, it's interesting because that has been an issue that has gotten a lot of attention, but it's breaking almost evenly. Of those that say roads is most important, 50% for Evers, but 47% for Walker. A very narrow difference on roads, whereas the other issues clearly favor one candidate or the other.
Let's take a call from Jim in Brookfield. Jim, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hey, good morning. Actually, some of my question has been answered by this. I'm concerned, whatever happened to, you know, it's the economy, stupid. I mean, when the economy is so good here, did you pinpoint numbers, and I think you just did note those. Well, I mean, with unemployment so low and jobs, you know, still out there for people, how does Tony Evers combat that? I mean, that's a big issue. I mean, he's got to acknowledge that the state of our economy is in very good hands right now.
I think that's right, in that we also ask what people's perceptions of the economy are. And a substantial plurality, not quite a majority, but a big plurality say the economy is better now than it was a year ago. Most of the others say it's about the same as a year ago, and it's a fairly small percentage that say it's worse. That's the global economy, or the economy, not the Wisconsin economy specifically. But I think you see in the economy and jobs issue how that is helping Walker, whereas the K-12 and healthcare were helping Evers. Walker also does very well on people who want to cut taxes as their most important problem, but that's only about 7% that picked taxes as the most important issue for them.
Jim, thank you for that call. How about Foxconn? How's that figuring into the election?
We've been monitoring Foxconn since the deal was finalized. And it's been pretty stable in what people think about it, with one exception this time. This time, 41% said they thought the state would get its money's worth from Foxconn. 40% said the state would not get its money's worth. That's the first time, even by just one percentage point, that Foxconn has looked like it was more people said it was worth it than not. On the other hand, 58% say it will help the Milwaukee area economically, but will it help your local businesses? 55% say not, only 33% say it will. And those last two haven't really changed much over the last 8 months.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He stays with us as we continue to dig into the results of the latest Marquette poll. What's your take on the state of the U.S. Senate race? What issues matter most with that race? And we'll still talk about the Attorney General's race as well. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about the latest Marquette Law School poll with Charles Franklin, who heads the poll, and he's with us to talk about the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you on this. What's your take on the Senate race? What issues matter to you in that race? And what about the Attorney General? That race is also considered a toss-up. What are you watching there? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or mention WPR Mornings on Twitter. Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. Charles, what's the state of the U.S. Senate race between U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and State Senator Leah Vuckmeer?
Unlike the very close governor's race, Tammy Baldwin is holding an 11-point lead, 54-43. That's hardly changed from a month from earlier in the month when it was a 10-point margin, 53-43. If the governor's race has been consistently pretty tight in our polling, the Senate race has consistently shown a Baldwin advantage of somewhere around 10 points, with the one exception of the August poll done right after the primary. So this race is outside the margin of error with that consistent Baldwin lead.
How has polling changed on this race over time?
Yeah, we've been pretty consistent with that lead. When we asked in June, for example, Baldwin was ahead by double digits, or 9 points, rather, sorry. And then that August poll was a tighter poll, but then it has been consistently wide. And again, outside polling organizations have also shown Baldwin substantially ahead. Vuckmeer has become better known to the public. Coming out of the primary, she was still unrecognized by over 60% of respondents. That's down to the low 20s now, which is still a little behind Tony Evers, who's a bit better known, but it's pretty widely known. One of the issues for Vuckmeer remains, has she fully unified the party behind her after a pretty bitter contest in the Republican primary?
And what about Baldwin's job rating?
She is a bit net positive. We ask favorable, unfavorable for Baldwin, and she was at 45 favorable, 40 unfavorable. That's unchanged since earlier in the month. Her long-term job or favorability has been close to even between favorable and unfavorable, with some polls a plus two or three and some a minus two or three. But over the last 8 months, her favorable rating has steadily risen, while her unfavorable has steadily declined. That's a bit unusual in a campaign season when often both sides suffer from rising unfavorable ratings.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We're talking about the last Marquette Law School poll before next week's election and kind of figuring out what it all means. We have some callers who want to join us. Let's go to Milwaukee, where Nate is ready to go. Nate, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was going to mention my preferred issue in the governor's race and also ask a question about what might have been in the poll. I'm concerned about gerrymandering because I think it takes away accountability from the people in government, and Mr. Walker has said he'll probably try to do it again. And also just plain trust, because I remember 4 years ago, Republicans were claiming that it was scare tactics for Democrats to say that Walker would make Wisconsin right to work if he stayed as governor. And right after getting reelected, he did. And now Walker's saying it's Democratic scare tactics to be concerned about pre-existing conditions. So I'm wondering what if you asked if people trust either candidate or not.
Good questions. We have not asked trust about the candidates in this cycle. We've asked about trust in government a good bit over the years, and it probably won't surprise you that trust in government's pretty low at this stage. But we have not asked specifically about the candidates or whether people think they will keep their promises, for example. What we have asked about that you mentioned is coverage of pre-existing conditions. And one of the interesting results there is that 82% say that coverage is very important to them. And those folks are breaking, the reason, the unanimity of that opinion is what I'm trying to say, is one of the reasons we see both campaigns, and for that matter, both Senate campaigns, talking about that issue and how they would handle that issue. All candidates these days seem to be saying we'll keep coverage of pre-existing conditions, but that flies in the face of opposition to the Affordable Care Act, which guarantees the coverage of pre-existing conditions. So this has become an issue in which both sides want to be in favor of pre-existing condition coverage, but we're having a bit of an argument about which one is more trustworthy on that issue.
And, Nate, thanks for that call. We had a caller, John from Menominee, who called in, couldn't stay with us, but he said he's concerned about health care and pre-existing conditions, and that seems like you're hearing a lot about that from all the other people you're polling, and so lots of people out there like John. I want to turn briefly to the attorney general race. Where do those polls stand in the race between incumbent Brad Schimmel and challenger Josh Call?
Well, that race has been tightening over time. It was a 7-point Schimmel lead in September, then a 4-point lead early October, and now it's just a 2-point lead in this latest poll. That's well inside the margin of error. Both of these candidates are much less well-known than the Senate and governor's candidates. Even Brad Schimmel, who's been in office for 4 years as attorney general, suffers from 45% of the public say they don't know enough about him to have an opinion of him. But Josh Call, even more, 72% say they don't have an opinion about him. Now, that's come down for Call from 92% in September. So the campaign is introducing him to voters. But here, with a week left, there's very little time for people to learn more about these candidates. We also saw that reflected in watching debates, where 75% said they'd not paid any attention to the attorney general's debates or the news coverage of them. Given that this is arguably the second most important statewide office, it's unfortunate, I think, that the campaign and the candidates and the election are not getting as much attention as the top two races for governor and Senate.
How enthusiastic are people about voting based on the latest polling?
Overall, pretty enthusiastic. We are estimating a turnout of between 2.4 and 2.5 million voters. That would be between the 2014 election here for governor and the 2012 recall election, but well below the 3 million that turn out in a presidential year. Finally, in contrast, in 2010, the year Walker was elected, only 2.1 million turned out. So we'd be a little surprised from our data if turnout is much below 2.4, but we'd be surprised if it was over 2.5.
Well, we do know that nearly 380,000 Wisconsinites have voted early this fall, a record number for a midterm election, and that number will go up as early voting continues. That comes from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, so that could perhaps be an indication. One other thing that I wanted to ask you about in your polling, do you get any sense at all of how third-party candidacies will affect one candidate or the other in any of these races?
There is a little bit of that, and it's especially with the governor's race, because that race is so close. In our data for the governor's race, Libertarian Phil Anderson is getting 3% overall. Anderson ran for Senate 2 years ago and got 2.96%, I believe. So 3% would be right in line with what he did in the Senate race. But that 3% is coming from Democrats. Democrats are going 93 for Evers, 3 for Walker, but they're also going 3 points for Anderson, the Libertarian, whereas no Republicans are doing that. Independents, as you'd expect, are more likely to go for Anderson at 5%. So this is a case where if the governor's race is as close as it seems to be in our data, all third party, and there's several other independent candidates on the ballot, could, in principle, accumulate enough votes to be the difference in the governor's race. And so there is some role that's being played there.
What else will you be watching for in the waning days of this election season?
Well, I think we mentioned enthusiasm a minute ago. Democrats this year are more enthusiastic than Republicans by about a 7-point margin. And that's been pretty consistent over the year. It's varied in exactly the size, but an average of about a 7-point Democratic advantage. Also, in response to our question, are you absolutely certain to vote? Democrats are a little bit more likely to vote this year than Republicans. That's unusual for a midterm here in Wisconsin, where the midterm electorate is usually a bit more Republican.
Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and professor of law and public policy. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com, the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, thank you for joining us.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
For more information about election coverage, visit WisconsinVote.org. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Studies show that 80% of Americans would like to die at home, but only about 20% actually do so. Our guest blames this costly discrepancy on our reluctance to talk about death. He gives us all the tips and tricks we need to start those conversations with our loved ones, doctors, caregivers, and ourselves. Do you and your loved ones avoid talking about death? Why? Have you ever tried having a conversation about death, how you want the end of your life to look with your family? What happened? Was there reluctance to talk about it? Or are you and your family very open about these types of things? And has that been a positive thing? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Three ways to get in touch. Michael Hebb is founder of the nonprofit deathoverdinner.org, which brings people together to, as you might expect, talk about death over dinner. He's also author of the book, Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. Michael Hebb, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
You say that the way we die in the modern age is broken. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, we can look at that in many different ways. For one thing, we're just not encountering death as much as we used to. And there, we have a lot to learn from learning about the fact that we're not going to be around forever. but there are other things that are very broken about the system of dying. We've professionalized or attempted to professionalize the fact that we die and medicalized, and people aren't given, you know, the power, don't feel empowered to make decisions about how they want their end-of-life care, which comes from a culture that really doesn't know how to have these conversations.
What do you mean that we aren't confronting death, or are we less involved with death? We're less aware that death happens. What exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, now that death has moved into the hospitals, and we used to be had much more of an encounter with our loved ones as they died, and we used to actually encounter bodies, quite frankly, more consistently. And now that we're just not in the presence of it, it doesn't come up in our experience, and you know that impacts many things.
As we mentioned, the studies show that 80% of Americans say they'd like to die at home. Only about 20% actually get to. Is this a product of the medicalization of death, that we end up in the hospital and that's where we pass away? Or is it that our wishes aren't being honored? Or is there some other reason?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a perfect storm. When you don't tell your loved ones what it is you want towards the end, there's a very good chance you're going to get the default, which is to keep you alive or to, you know, essentially medicalize your experience at all costs. And, you know, say the question again?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, why there's this huge gap between what we say we want and what actually happens.
Yeah, and it really comes down to communication. And, you know, Atul Gawande made this very clear in Being Mortal in his work after that incredibly influential book, is that if we don't have this conversation and our loved ones aren't able to really advocate for us in the face of, you know, the difficulties that come around with a terminal diagnosis, or if we're in the ICU, then we're not going to be able to get those wishes granted in the face of these tragedies.
So why is it so hard for us to talk about death?
Well, I have a lot of compassion for people not having these conversations. It took me 5 years of doing this work and gathering people at the dinner table to have a conversation with my mom and my brother. And, you know, I literally have been around the world having these discussions, and yet the most important conversation took me quite a lot of time. And there's a lot of reason why it is so difficult. One, you know, there's the basic cognitive bias, just a basic system in our brain that has us not want to face these issues. And, you know, this Daniel Kahneman, his Nobel Prize-winning work around cognitive bias, laid out several of these that impact our conversation about death. We think we're an exception. We don't like to bring up an uncomfortable topic, that we're something that makes someone uncomfortable. If we haven't experienced something, it's hard for us to opine about it. So you put all of these things together, and then you think about a culture that isn't encountering end of life as much as it used to, and then we're in the situation we're in, where it becomes a taboo, and we have then very little literacy around this topic, very little comfort. And when you don't have literacy, you don't have access to empowered decisions.
You mean we don't have the language to talk about it?
Yeah, we've lost the language, we've lost the comfort and fluency, I think that's changing. I mean, what we've seen is, instead of having singular individuals like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross or Jessica Mitford, or these people that had to shoulder so much work alone, now that there's a great community of people working on opening this topic back up and giving people access to making, having conversations they need to have, making sure their loved ones know their wishes, talking about death in all of its stripes. So that we're starting to see this come back into culture, which for me means that it's really going to transform the type of care people get and the way that we honor our loved ones after they're gone.
Is this a uniquely American problem?
No, I don't think it is. I think every culture does certain aspects of this well, and other aspects not so well. It is just a difficult topic. And you know, the other thing that I like to say to people is, you know, you'll often point a finger at somebody in your life and say, well, my spouse or my parents, they don't want to have the conversation, and I don't know what they want. And there's a lot of blame that happens around this, you know, why we don't talk. And I like to remind people that all of us are having a conversation in our own heads. I mean, we know we're mortal. And so there is a conversation happening. The question is whether or not we've made the people in our lives comfortable enough, whether they feel like there's an open enough communication between the two of us where they'll share that conversation they're already having in their heads.
Michael Hebb is the founder of the nonprofit deathoverdinner.org, which brings people together to, well, talk about death over dinner. And he's also author of the book, Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. You can join our conversation. What's the hardest thing for you about talking about death with your loved ones? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. So, Michael, where's a good starting point for getting better at this?
Well, the way that we laid the book out is around some basic conversational prompts. And this is the way the website works as well. And there's and there are prompts that, you know, conversation starter topics around death that people can pull off the internet as well. And for me, I like the idea of people having these resources and having different routes into the conversation, like questions that you can ask your loved ones or answer for your loved ones or friends that don't seem so daunting at first. Like, you know, if you could choose your last meal, you know, what would that be, right? That's a, it's almost like a prosaic, like pop culture question that feels somewhat comfortable to people, but you're really talking about, you know, how you want things to be towards the end. You're also talking about the things that you value most, or what song would you like played at your funeral? So these almost icebreaker questions allow the beginning of a conversation to take place, and then, you know, move your way into a conversation about what, you know, what do you want to have happen to your body? And what would you like end-of-life care to look like? Do we make sure that we keep you alive at all costs? Which there is no judgment on that. If that's what somebody wants, if they want everything, every intervention possible, then that should be identified and their family should know. The reality is most people don't want that, and that doesn't get communicated.
You have put together a list of questions that people can pull from when they're trying to have these conversations with their friends, loved ones, and caregivers. And we kind of touched on a number of those, and the key one here is about medical intervention at the end of life. In the book, you speak to a grief specialist who grew up in Hong Kong and thinks Westerners have a particular discomfort talking about death because Western medicine tends to think it can beat death. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, there hasn't been any room in the medical education process, or very little room to talk about death, to talk about end of life, and we want them focused on healing us. It's not that I expect doctors to be you know, great experts in that side of care, but there's an opportunity for great improvement. And, you know, we just recently started working with, partnered with the Cleveland Clinic to create a medical edition of Death Over Dinner, and which will be launching this in a few months. And that really will give us an opportunity to engage, you know, tens of thousands of doctors and nurses and administrators around this conversation. So I'm excited about the prospect.
Why are we so reluctant to have conversations about end-of-life issues with family members? We're talking about that with Michael Hebb, and we will continue that conversation in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. With polls showing that most of us want to die at home and statistics showing that very few of us actually do, my guest says it's more important than ever that we talk about end-of-life issues with our family members. Do you and your family members avoid talking about death? Why do you think that is? And have you tried having a conversation? How did that go? What's the hardest thing about talking about death with your loved ones? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael Hebb is founder of the nonprofit DeathOverDinner.org and also the author of Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important question. Let's take some phone calls. Michael, Rhonna Jones joins us in Rice Lake, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Excuse me. Good morning. I'm happy to be on the program. My dad lived through the 30s and 40s, and we farmed, and so he watched my grandmother run up and down the stairs, care for the old folks upstairs in their various stages, make meals, do everything. So my dad was terribly worried about being a, you know, what's, oh gosh, I just had the word. like ruining my life, basically, came in to live with us. And we talked about it for years. Mom never had that experience, but Dad did. And so eventually we all came to the conclusion that when it came time for them to pass, they would live with us, my husband and myself. My husband's gracious enough to assume part of the caretaking role for my dad. My mom still does not need a lot of care, but my dad lives with us. He has dementia, Parkinson's, and needs care. And we've had many discussions about, you know, what's going to happen. And they have their living wills in place. But what I find is kind of funny now is that as they progress in their particular diagnoses of disease, they change things. And knowing that they're changing things because they're not really, in my limited knowledge, they're not really them at that moment. And I don't know, all I can say is having my dad live with me, regardless of his condition, is one more day with my dad that I'll never be able to place if he lived in a different care facility and I couldn't be with him every day.
Rona, thanks for that call. Michael Hebb?
Yeah, well, I think it's a remarkable story that you're talking about, and I'm glad that your family's having these open conversations where you're able to talk about your concerns and your fears, and again, not just be on the default setting. The thing that we didn't talk about earlier, focusing more on end of life, you know, what care we want, the great part about these conversations is they're not morbid. They tend to be, like, when people have these death dinners and when they go through the prompts in the book, they end up having conversations about life and how they want to live, what their priorities are. There's laughter, there's joy, and there's a profound sense of human connection. And people tend to describe the dinners and the conversations as magic, which you'd think would be a little bit surprising. But it's really that we're talking about life, and that's what I think Rana was just telling us about, how they're living together at the end instead of just dying.
Let's take another call. This time it'll be Karen from Madison. Karen, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say how grateful I am for this kind of experience. I am a death awareness educator in the Madison area that has been hosting something a little more informal, I guess, for about the last 4.5 years. We have monthly death cafes or community conversations on death and dying, which is another initiative that was prompted by, I think, other people who have similar concerns that people really hesitate to talk about these things, but once they're invited to do so in a way that seems more normal, like I really want to do a death over dinner event soon. It's just we've been doing these more casual conversations for so long. It seems like, I don't know exactly what audience will be drawn to it. So I'm just wondering if the speaker could talk a little bit about who are the best guests.
Karen, thanks for that call. Michael Hebb?
Yeah, and Karen mentioned death cafes, which is a great movement that started in London and then has taken off globally. In some ways, very similar to Death Over Dinner, and also quite a bit different. As she mentioned, it's a public forum, a community forum around these conversations. The reason why I created Death Over Dinner, and really the book, is so people have the permission and the tools, almost like a script or a board game that you can play with your family or friends, so that the people that are closest to you have the opportunity to hear what your wishes are and how you feel about life, death, and all of the fears and hopes surrounding it. So I would, to answer your question, I'd start with friends and you know, people you feel comfortable with, almost like who you'd invite over for a board game night, and then I'd say go to the family, to your close knit family.
Karen, thanks for that call. Michael Hebb is Are family gatherings for things like, I don't know, birthdays, anniversaries, holidays, is that a good time to talk with the family about death, and why or why not?
Well, yeah, people like to say, oh, Thanksgiving's coming up. What a great time for a death dinner. And I, you know, even though, you know, I want to be like, yes, of course, the more the better. I really caution people. This is not a thing to surprise your family or your friends with. You know, it's no Thanksgiving surprise. We're talking about that tonight. It's not going to go over well with the majority of families.
Well, these days, it might work better than politics.
Right. Well, just to your point, families are fraught with tension and with some division around things like politics. So I think we need anything we can to bring us closer together. So it's consent-based.
Sure.
It should be. And this work always is. So let people know. Give them the opportunity to opt in.
Another topic that comes up in your book is legacy. Why is it important that we talk about what we want our legacy to be when we die?
Now, there's a couple reasons. You know, some people really are invested in knowing how their ideas or projects they started or who they were to extend into the future. And we want to give those people who have that desire in our lives the opportunity. The other thing is we really want to know how to honor the people that we lose. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the main ones, well, one, it feels good to know and to honor the people we love, but it also reduces the length of our grief and the depth of our grief. If we know how our loved ones want their memorial to be or something that we can do for them ongoingly when they're not here, it's been shown study after study that that actually reduces the depth of depression, grief, sense of loss, because we, you know, they call it grief work because then we have something for our hands to actually take part in.
What's one question we can ask our spouse or family member at dinner tonight to start this conversation?
You know, I would, again, start a little bit on the lighter side. Depends on the relationship and what you talk about generally. I think one question that is a great introductory question is, when did you first realize that you were going to die, that you weren't immortal, maybe you even can say. You can keep it very light on that side. Like, when did you realize that, you know, you weren't going to live forever? How old were you, and what was that realization like? Not a question we have or a conversation we have every day with our spouses.
It certainly isn't, and that's where we'll leave this conversation. Michael Hebb, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. What a pleasure.
Michael Hebb is founder of the nonprofit deathoverdinner.org, which brings people together to talk about death over dinner. He's the author of the book, Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, An Invitation and Guide to Life's Most Important Conversation. Well, you heard this conversation on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson.